This is a University of Otago podcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For people who don't know me, I'm Peter Joyce. I'm Dean at University of Otago Christchurch. And it's wonderful for us to be back in this building after 2 years out of the building. And it's wonderful to see such an audience at tonight's first of seven health lecture series. We've put on these health lectures for many years, and prior to the earthquake I always had to say, if you're parked in the public car park, make sure you're there by 8:30 because the car park closes. But you don't need to worry about that because the car park's closed all the time, and therefore you've got no risk of, no chance of getting your car out if it happens to be in there. But anyway, this is a tradition that's been going on for many years, putting on these health lecture series every autumn. And tonight we're very fortunate to have Professor Martin Kennedy delivering, and it's not just a public health lecture, but it's also his inaugural professorial lecture, which he was meant to have delivered 2 years ago, but events intervened. Now, Martin took a science degree at the University of Canterbury. He then completed a PhD at the University of Auckland, postdoc work at University of Cambridge, and returned to be on our staff from 1986. In 2010, he was promoted to professor. For many years, as happens with many of our researchers, he was living from one grant to the next grant, and I'm sure in case Martin doesn't mention it, we would particularly like to thank Mary Carney, hence the Carney Centre, for her philanthropy, and the donation she's made to the university, which has assisted Martin with his research. So without further ado, I'll invite Martin Kennedy to come and deliver this first health lecture. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to see a lot of friends and family in the audience, but I can see there's also people I don't know, so people must have come under their own volition, so I'm very grateful to you all. I'm going to talk tonight about some scientific themes, and my talk is going to include some scientific themes, which I guess is appropriate. And you can see the themes listed here, and I'm not going to go through them in any particular order, but these are the kinds of, I guess, main points I'll be addressing on the scientific side. But as Peter said, this is also the, you know, my inaugural professorial lecture, and you don't get very many opportunities to look back over your career and you know, maybe bore people with it. But I thought I'd take a bit of liberty and do that for the first few minutes. So I'm going to talk about, you know, my training and why I ended up coming here. What are the things that made me end up in doing what I now do? And my youngest daughter, Laura, probably won't thank me for putting this out, but this is a picture, I think, of my life that she drew on a notice board in my office about 10 years ago. And I think it sums it up pretty well, although she claims to not really know what I do, so maybe by the end of tonight she'll have a better idea. So as Peter said, my first taste of genetics was at Canterbury University in 1978. I hadn't found that much at high school that interested me, except there was quite a nice girl that I eventually married, but academically I'm not sure I really achieved very highly. And when I finally decided to go to university, I did all the subjects I hadn't already done, which included biology. And this chap here, Laurie Greenfield, lectured to the first year students. And he was some of you will know Laurie. He's a terrific lecturer, very animated and quite eccentric, but very he presented things in a very interesting way. And somewhere in the middle of the first year, he talked about genetic engineering and recombinant DNA. And it kind of hooked me. I was intrigued by this. And in my second year, Chris Mahanty, who's the other gentleman shown here, Chris now lives in Melbourne. Chris had a very good second year course in genetics, which gave me a chance to learn some hands-on genetics and to fuel the fire, as it were. And I eventually went on and did an honours degree at Canterbury. And the good thing about that was in the fourth year of your degree, you could do a research project. Now, the research project, I think, was 20% of the course, and I'm sure I spent about 80% of my time in the lab because it was an interesting experience. And the thing I chose to do, this is just a cartoon, I'm sure you all know what a bacterium is, and you probably all know that there's a chromosome in most bacteria, but you may not know that bacteria also carry around in the cell these little plasmids. They're little circular pieces of DNA, and they're capable of replicating, copying themselves, and being passed on. So they can be passed on when the cell divides, but they can also be passed on horizontally to other bacteria. And so there were at least a couple of reasons why these are fascinating. One is that the genes for antibiotic drug resistance are carried on these plasmids. And the other is that they're really the basis of all the genetic engineering techniques. So if you want to clone a gene and look at it, then a plasmid is what you use to do it in. So it was an interesting topic to work on. Here's my honours project in all its glory, with a very understated and, well, appropriate title, really. Now, this is one of the results, one of the few results I got in my honours project, but I'm very proud of it. It doesn't look pretty, but it's a gel, an agarose gel, we call it. It's a way of separating plasmids. I'm pretty sure, in fact, I'm certain it was the first agarose gel ever run at Canterbury University, and I'm sure it's the first time anybody ever actually could see plasmid DNA. And this is a way of separating plasmids by size. You can see the chromosomal DNA of the bacteria here, and you can see these bands here with a bit of imagination, and they're the plasmids in the cells. And I was very proud of that, even by today's standards. It looks pretty gross and not very pretty, but I can't tell you how much blood, sweat and tears went into producing that gel. I had to do pretty much everything myself because no one else had done these sorts of things at the university before that. And I learned that you could actually, by reading and by being diligent and by making lots of mistakes, you could actually get somewhere useful and get something going. But I also learned that it was no fun doing things, reinventing the wheel all by yourself all the time. And if you really want to learn something, you're better to go somewhere where things are being done, where there's a good group already with many methods and resources set up. And so I chose to do my PhD in Auckland. I headed up there in 1982. And my supervisors were David Lane and Peter Berquist, and they ran a lab which focused entirely on bacterial plasmids, one in particular, which was called Mini-F plasmid. Probably too much detail, I suspect. But this plasmid was an interesting model. They were trying to understand how it copied itself. How did it replicate? Because it was, well, they claimed it was a good model of chromosome replication and therefore medically relevant. But I think you'd be hard put to get medical research funding for this sort of work today. But they had a whole lab working on these things, and I had a fantastic 3 to 4 years in David and Peter's lab. I learned a lot about genetic engineering, recombinant DNA, and DNA sequencing, and some of these things I'll talk about. But I can tell you it was really, really hard. If I was at a party and I had to explain what the heck I did for a living, or not much of a living actually, just what I did to fill in my time, this is a very difficult thing to tell people. And I'd sort of decided that I'd like to take these skills that I'd learned here and bring them back closer to a human medical system. Before I left Auckland, this is ready for the friends in the audience, a very close friend gave me this card after I'd left Auckland, and I could never work out why she thought that was an appropriate card for me, but I'll leave you to figure that out. So I came back to Christchurch in 1986, and I was very lucky to get a job with Peter Fitzgerald and Peter Crossan, and I'm not sure if Peter Fitz is here, but I was delighted to see Peter Crossan is here, and Christine Morris. Christine Morris was also in the group, and a couple of others, Peter Hollings and Mike Bodger, some of you may know. So Peter ran the cytogenetics group here at the hospital, and he was actually a plant biologist who had developed or been using techniques called cytogenetics, where you look at chromosomes. And he'd shifted over into the hospital and was being funded by Cancer Society to look at chromosomes and to help with the diagnoses. And so Peter, the two Peters and Christine, were all very good at cytogenetics, about which I knew nothing. So I was able to bring my bacterial genetics expertise to this lab, and we could start to apply these techniques to try and understand some of these chromosome rearrangements in more detail. And the thing that we were most interested in is a cartoon of two chromosomes coloured differently. This is all, you know, fabrication. They don't look different colours generally. But in leukemia or cancers of the blood, you often get a chromosome translocation. That's illustrated here, where you can see an exchange of material between the, you know, one arm of the chromosomes. So some of the material on the purple chromosome is moved over to the other chromosome and vice versa. Often this is a seminal, you know, event in the start of a cancer. And what we find now, what we now know, is that often at the break point where the two chromosomes have joined, there will be one or maybe a couple of genes that actually are disrupted or changed in function by this, what we call the translocation. So these break points are a source of fascination, and we were learning a lot about cancer by looking at them. But it's important for young scientists to go a bit further afield and broaden their horizons and head overseas. And so after 3 years in Christchurch, I was planning to head overseas. It's a bit hard to plan, though. As Peter said earlier, it's quite hard to get funding at any stage of your career. And it's quite hard for young scientists to get funding to travel overseas. And it was difficult now and it was difficult then. And I've always kept these two pages from my diary, 1988-1989, with all the fellowships I could apply for, marked in, and all the deadlines and all the closing dates and so forth. And I can just say it was a fairly chaotic and stressful year for the whole family. But I won out in the end, fortunately, and I got to a lab in Cambridge that I was very keen to go to. Here I am, a very happy boy being there. And my boss was, his name was Terry Rabbits, and Terry was pretty famous in the world of chromosome translocations and leukemia genetics. He worked in this building, the Laboratory of Molecular Biology, and that's where my lab was, up on the fourth floor. This is a remarkable place. It was and is a remarkable place. In this lab, the director of my division was Cesar Milstein. He had a Nobel Prize for discovering antibodies. Down the corridor was Max Perutz. He had a Nobel Prize. Further down the corridor was Aaron Klug, and he had had a Nobel Prize. Fred Sanger was still there, and he had two Nobel Prizes. So, you know, this remarkable place had seven Nobel Prizes when I was there in 89 to 91. Since I've come back to New Zealand, two more Nobel Prizes have been awarded to scientists at the LMB, what we call the LMB, or Laboratory of Molecular Biology. Really a remarkable place and a fantastic learning experience for a young scientist. I believe the LMB now looks like this. I haven't seen it yet. I think that's a photograph. And a huge new building has just been erected, and so clearly it's in good form. I spent a lot of time at the LMB learning to make transgenic mice. So I was putting genes into mice or knocking genes out of mice. I don't really have time to talk about that. They're actually wonderful techniques that have taught us an awful lot about how genes function. It didn't prove, I mean, I learnt the techniques and was applying them. It was pretty tough and arduous, and it certainly wasn't being as productive as you might like in terms of publications, which are sort of the thing that a young scientist needs to ensure they survive in science, are really publications. And I had the good sense about 6 months before my fellowship came to an end to say to my boss, actually, I wouldn't mind working on that project. So I was a bit forward, and a Spanish colleague was leaving, and his project had sort of was foundering a bit. And I said to Terry, I'd quite like to work on that. And he said, sure, go for it, and threw everything at me. And that turned out to be a really good move because I was fortunate with the cloning and sequencing skills that I had. It was relatively straightforward to get all the answers. And we were lucky to discover at a chromosome breakpoint, this is a picture of it here actually, between chromosomes 10 and 14, we had isolated a piece of DNA that contained a new gene that nobody had seen before. But that gene was part of a family of genes that are normally involved in development of the organism. And this, you might think this is out of context, but here's a fruit fly head, and the fruit fly has legs instead of antenna. And this is a very famous fruit fly. The mutation that causes this has been studied for many decades, long time before we did this work. And this defined a group of genes called homeobox or Hox genes that helped lay down the body plan. And we'd found a gene in this leukemia that actually belonged to that family. And so when it was expressed aberrantly after the translocation, it caused the leukemia. So that was, I didn't know it at the time, but that turns out to be my best, most cited paper. But that's often the way when you go to a well-resourced laboratory and you have the opportunity to do good work. But a fantastic learning experience. But all good things come to an end, and I was pretty excited to come back home to Christchurch and back to the lab where the various Peters and Mike and others, some of you will recognise, were working. And really, I'm now going to perhaps stop talking about my past career. I'm going to fast forward at least a decade, because although we did a lot of things during that period, I just can't really speak to them, apart from confusing you all. I'll run out of time. So I'm going to really fast forward now to a slightly different era. I've put in a few random shots, photographs of some fantastic artworks at different laboratories around the world, really just to remind me to take a breath and to tell you that I'm about to change tack and go off at another tangent. So I'm about to do that. This is my Biology 101 slide, so I'm sure that some of you, or many of you probably already know this, but just to make sure we're on the same page, I need to tell you a little bit about DNA, chromosomes, and genes. Here's a person, here's some cells, and the cell has a nucleus, and in the nucleus are a bunch of chromosomes. Just looking at it another way, some cells, a nucleus, and a chromosome, and if we were to unthread the chromosome, we would see the DNA molecule, which is wrapped up and the chromosome. And I remember being told that you had to tell people something three times before they get it, so I'm going to tell you this a third time. Here's a chromosome. This is a different view. It's a human chromosome. You can see a protein scaffold. So this is just protein now. And the DNA has been blasted off that chromosome and spread all around this glass. Well, it's probably not glass, actually. It's metal. And this has been put under an electron microscope. And so if you zoom in, not sure how well you can see it, but you can probably see that this grey mass is really just a continuous thread of DNA, enormously long thread of DNA. This is a chromosome, basically consists of a huge mass of DNA wrapped up very tightly and in an ordered fashion by protein. And as crass molecular biologists, we like to reduce this long DNA sequence or long DNA strand down to a bunch of letters in a computer, and we just write them down left to right. And I'll talk about the methods we use for doing this shortly. The DNA is made up of four bases, A, C, G, T, and it's the order of those bases that define the genetic information. I need to tell you now what a genome is, because I'm going to ramble on about the genome quite a bit. It's quite simple, really. The genome is the DNA from all of our chromosomes, 3 billion bases of it, and as I've said, they're all made up of A's, C's, G's, and T's in different orders. So very elegant chemical molecule, very long, full of information. Surprisingly, there are only about 20,000 genes in that huge mass of DNA. Still a lot of genes, but not as many as we originally thought there would be. Okay, when I talk about genetics, I can't help be enthusiastic and excited, so forgive me. But there have been a lot of revolutions, and I'm now old enough to have seen real revolutions and know what they look like. So I'm going to talk at least briefly about five revolutions that I've experienced through my career. I haven't really contributed to these, but I've really enjoyed using the revolutions to further our research. So I'll go through these, and you'll know we've reached a point, a revolution, when you see a number, and I'll just gradually work through them, and that will let you know how far I have to go through the talk as well. The first one is easy. I don't know that there certainly aren't any students in my lab who worked before the polymerase chain reaction was invented. During my PhD, this technique had not been invented, so everything I did was done the old way. So we divide genetics into two eras, really. There's the pre-PCR era, before PCR was invented, and after PCR was invented. That's how important it was. It's a method for amplifying DNA. So, and I can't explain the details to you in the time we have. Peter wouldn't give me 2 hours to talk, so. But basically, you can take DNA from a blood sample or from any other sample, put it in a test tube, and with a very simple method, you can amplify it exponentially. So what that means is you can take complex DNA, and in a test tube, in one afternoon, you can amplify up any piece of that DNA that you want, any part of that genome that you want, and you can see it represented here. The guy who thought of this worked in California, Cary Mullis, a very interesting character. He developed the method, and it became public about 1986, which was the last year of my PhD, so I never used it in my PhD. And I don't think I started using it until I got to Cambridge, although it was being used in Christchurch before that time. He got the Nobel Prize in 1993 for PCR, and rightly so. I'd love to spend a lot of time talking about the applications of PCR, but I've got plenty of other stuff to talk about, I'm afraid, but these are just some of the applications. So whenever you see anything that's, you know, in the news about, you know, the car park King Richard, Auntie from the Wairau Bar, anything about conservation biology, the size of a population, or molecular archaeology, forensic DNA fingerprinting and so on, all of these depend on PCR. So it's really changed the way we do things. And just to ram it home, this is a photo that Alison in my lab took this afternoon for me. It's a rank of PCR machines in our lab. Very simple machines. They're basically just ovens, computer-controlled ovens. And it's the reagents we put in the tubes that actually make the whole thing go. But these are essential tools that we use. Okay, so revolution number two was the Human Genome Project. And this is old news now. I guess it's around about the turn of the century that the Human Genome Project was completed. A lovely quote there from Svante Paabo, a Swedish molecular biologist who's actually recently just sequenced the Neanderthal genome using a lot of PCR techniques and other things. And so this has been a template for almost everything we do in genetics today. And it's important to note that the Human Genome Project was argued for and carried out, and believe me, it had $3 billion of funding from various governments around the world and also charities. It was an enormous project and caused quite a lot of controversy when it was being done. But the argument for doing the Human Genome Project was it would accelerate our understanding of human genetic disease. So now I'm going to have to tell you about human genetic disease in very broad terms. So when we think about disease, if I say genetic disease, I'm sure most of you are thinking about families you may know with cystic fibrosis or some of these terrible, you know, terrible inherited diseases. And that's certainly one category of genetic disease. We call it Mendelian diseases. Okay, so they're diseases that result from damage to one gene. Okay, one gene is damaged. It may be the two copies of the gene, but it's definitely one gene that causes a Mendelian disease, things like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease and so forth. And if you have that mutated gene, you will have the disease. And you'll see very clear patterns of inheritance in a family. So these are the what we would consider to be the traditional genetic diseases. And this is what was prevalent in the research, you know, domain when I was a student and right through as a postdoc, because we could study these diseases and we could find the genes, and we didn't have any tools to study the other class of diseases. So the other class of diseases we call complex diseases, and they're rightly named. So complex diseases arise from the effect of many risk genes, not one, but many. And by many, I might mean hundreds or possibly 1,000 in some cases. And each of those genes has a tiny effect on your risk of disease. Okay, but unlike the Mendelian diseases, the complex diseases are influenced very strongly by the environment. Okay, and by the environment, I mean what you eat, how much exercise you do, what you smoke, whether you are under stress all the time, etc., etc. So many, many different things in the environment. Okay, so these are the two main categories of genetic disease. And you'll know why I'm going on about complex traits when I put up a very, very much a partial list of some complex diseases. Okay, so there's no one in the room who isn't either affected, directly or indirectly by more than one of these. And I could put up another two slides listing complex diseases. So these are the things that get us all in the end. Okay, and they all have a genetic component. But as I've said, the genes are only part of the story. I'll tell you three times kind of thing. I'm going to tell you this again. So thinking about complex diseases, they're caused by a combination of environmental and genetic factors. In the old days, we used to call environment nurture. There could be many environmental factors. Some of them might be big, some of them might be small. We don't know what they are in many cases. And then there's a whole bunch of genes. Up until recently, we didn't know what many of these were either. Some of them have a reasonably large effect, but mostly the effect sizes are small. And it's the interaction of these two things that causes the disease. So until you get an interaction of some kind, I know it's, you know, my students go, ah. But anyway, it's animation. So you need the interaction of the two things to get the disease. Neither the genes alone or the environmental factors alone are sufficient. Okay, and I know this is sort of technical, and I'll try to move on shortly, but I also need to tell you a little bit. I've been talking about disease genes, and when I say disease genes, they're not genes that cause disease. They're perfectly normal genes that you probably need for normal life, but they have differences in their DNA. So somebody with a disease gene has the same gene, but it differs slightly to, you know, someone without the disease. So we can think of two general categories, and the first one are the mutations which cause, you know, straight inherited disease or Mendelian disease, and these are generally rare, and they're, we would consider them abnormal variation. Okay, they're a problem, they cause disease, no two ways about it, and they're not good. And then we have a lot of other DNA variations in the population that are perfectly normal. We call these polymorphisms. I'm sorry, I couldn't find another word. Polymorphisms, it's going to have to be. It just means many forms. Okay, so we have many, many differences between each other, and these are generally regarded as polymorphisms. They're common, and they're in the population. And they help make us all unique. I mean, if we all had identical DNA, we would look very similar, and we would behave similarly. We may not be identical, but we'd be pretty similar. So these polymorphisms might have some effect on gene function, so some of them do, but many of them don't. But you can use them as markers or signposts in the genome if you're trying to find genes. So that's the beauty of them. Again, just to say, it's what we call a single nucleotide polymorphism. This is the most common sort of polymorphism in the human genome. And now I can stop talking about polymorphisms and I can talk about SNPs. So we call them SNPs or SNPs. This just shows the DNA from two different people. Doesn't matter where it is, but it could be Peter here and it could be someone on the other side of the theatre. And you read their DNA and you'll find that every now and then you get a single base that's different. It's a T here and it's a C here. That's a SNP. Each of us have about 10 million of those in our genomes. Remember, we've got 3 billion bases of DNA, so this is only a small percentage of our DNA that differs, but it's very useful. Over the past decade or longer, thanks to the input of engineers, computer scientists, physicists, and even some biologists, many methods for developing rapid, high-throughput ways of genotyping, or sorry, that's a word I shouldn't really use, of looking at SNPs. Have been developed. So we now have many different technology platforms that allow us to look at multiple gene variants in different individuals. And a lot of these depend on DNA chips. So you have a chip that actually can look at a million polymorphisms in each person in a very relatively simple process. Okay, so these high throughput SNP detection methods have been crucial in the third revolution. So this is a genuine revolution that's come about really in the last 7 or 8 years, maybe the last decade. We call them genome-wide association studies, or GWAS. And so I said to you before that we had good methods for finding the genes underlying Mendelian diseases, you know, the diseases caused by single genes, but we had no real methods, not really effective methods, for finding the genes underlying all those complex diseases. But that changed in the mid-2000s. So the question is, can we find genes which influence your risk of complex disease? And the answer is yes, we can use this technique. What we need are many patients, or cases as we call them, with a particular disease, and we need many unaffected controls without the disease. And basically, we look at all their SNPs. It's as simple as that. We use the machines to look at all the SNPs, and then we compare the pattern of SNPs between the cases and the controls. So it's a straight comparison. And, you know, I hope that makes at least a little bit of sense. Maybe if you see this is the standard output from a GWAS. It's called a Manhattan plot because it looks like the New York skyline, and it's basically the genome lined up end to end along this bottom axis, the x-axis. And you can see chromosome 1, chromosome 2, chromosome 3 in different colours. And this is a statistical scale here, and basically when you get green dots above the plot, that tells you that there's a skewing and the frequency of a particular SNP in the cases versus the controls. Okay, so it's a purely statistical method, but what it does is it takes you straight to the genes. And so on this plot, we can say there's a gene on chromosome 1, maybe another one there, one on chromosome 2, 3, a whole lot on chromosome 5, 6, and so forth, and a big one on 16. So this method, if it's done correctly, takes you straight to the genes, more or less, that are involved in a given disease. And this is a classic study that the Wellcome Trust at the Sanger Centre in the UK did several years ago, where they did about 7 or 8 of these diseases in one go, and they found a whole host of genes involved in complex disease using this method. And it's been applied all over the world in many ways. And we had some small involvement in understanding the genetics of inflammatory bowel disease with the gastroenterologists here, particularly Richard Geary, Murray Barclay and colleagues. And some of these genes that were identified by GWAS, we were able to look at in the Christchurch patients and show that they were important in those patients. But the point of this slide, so this is really about inflammatory bowel disease, or Crohn's disease is the main form, and it's the best understood of all the complex diseases. We now have 200 genes that we know are important in Crohn's disease. And if you put all those, don't worry about the complexities of this diagram, the point is there are 3 boxes here. And those boxes are the groups into the functional groups into which you can fit the genes that have been found to be involved in IBD. There's basically 3 functional groupings. You can have genes that are involved in the barrier function of the gut. You can have genes that are involved in the immune response. And you can have genes that are involved in the cellular response of the cells in the actual gut wall. And this actually defines some very interesting pathways. That all of these things represent drug targets, and if nothing else. But as a whole, the information they give us and the way they sort of paint a picture of the disease, this is something we haven't had. This is really in the last 5 years, all of this genetics has started painting out the biochemistry and what we call the pathogenesis, if you like, of these diseases. And this is just one of many examples. So this is a map from the National Human Genome Research Institute in the United States. You can't see the chromosomes anymore behind the map, but believe me, they're there. And every dot is a dot showing the location of a gene involved in a complex disease. And these have all been found in the last decade. Most of them have been found in the last, since about 2006, I think, when the first GWAS was published. So it's remarkable progress in a very short space of time. Okay, right, time for me to take a breath and change tack yet again. And there's still some people awake, so I hope I haven't completely destroyed you all. So I want to talk now about DNA sequencing, because when we say DNA sequencing, we mean unraveling the order of the bases in the DNA, because that is giving us the code, and we can see how the code differs between different people, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a DNA sequencing gel that I ran in 1989, July, and it's the old-fashioned way. The method was actually developed by Fred Sanger at the Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge. He got a Nobel Prize for developing this method. And this is how we were doing it in the early 90s. And here's a picture of me, hard at work. I'd run the gel on here. I was using a really fancy tool called a sonic digitizer, which was like a pen, which meant you just blipped each of these bands, and it would make a noise, and the computer would tell you whether it was an A, C, G, or a T. And 90% of the time, it got it right. So you could put your DNA sequences in the computer. And I didn't say it, but that all involved using radioisotopes and, you know, exposing things to X-ray film. And it was very manual and tedious process, but very informative. And then you'd get this kind of computer printout, where every time you read part of the DNA, you could overlap it, you could find the bits, and then by repeating the sequencing, you could sort it all out and get it right. That was great. It's a fantastic technique. So that was 1986, when the last year I finished my PhD. That's how I was doing DNA sequencing, with a bit of lab work, quite a bit of cloning of stuff into molecules and isolating DNA and radioisotopes and other things. I could get 600 bases of DNA in one run, which was fabulous, and it might have taken me a couple of weeks. Today, on the campus at Otago University, we have a machine that will do 600 gigabases of DNA sequence in 2 days. That's lots of noughts on there, okay? And that that equates to 5 human genomes in 2 days at 30 times coverage. Okay, so I think if you say this is a quantum leap, you are completely understating the advances in the technology. This is extraordinary. So we can generate DNA sequence like nothing else. We just need to pour money in the top of the machine. And this is what our life now looks like. Okay, we have all this stuff coming at us, and to be honest, we are really only just trying to get our feet in terms of how we analyze it. There are many institutions around the world doing this, and we rely on them putting their software and their tools on the World Wide Web so we can use them, and so we're just trying to fall in behind and make use of this technology. This brings me to, and you'll be relieved, this is the last of the revolutions, but I've still got some time left, so we're not quite there yet. So this is a revolution that is really just upon us now, and I call it the personal genome era. So as I've said, a single DNA sequencer can now do what the 100 labs involved in the Human Genome Project took 10 years and $3 billion to do, can now do it in a day. So what does that mean? It means we can sequence lots and lots of genomes. And that's what's happening. And so sequencing a genome is useful, but we struggle to understand what all that sequence means. So we understand a small percentage of it. So all of that information is confusing, to be honest, at the moment, although that situation will change. And it's still quite expensive to do a whole human genome. It's about $5,000 to $10,000, which is ridiculously cheap compared to $3 billion for the first one. But there is an even cheaper way of getting high-quality information out of the genome, and we call it the human exome. It's a strange name, but essentially what this technique does is it sequences all 20,000 genes. It doesn't worry about the stuff in between. The stuff in between is often important. I'm not underrating it. But this is a concentrated form of genome information. And the name exome comes because the genes are made up of little bits, shown in the green here. And those little bits are called exons, and we have methods that, and there are kits, believe it or not, that allow you to pull all of the exons out of a DNA prep and then put them into one of these sequences. So you can just pull out those exons and put them into a sequencer, and you get this exome data. So this represents 1% of the human genome, but it contains most of the mutations we might be interested in, and it costs less than $1,000. We've done 36 of these now for people in Christchurch for research projects, although we have yet to analyse some of those. And I've got bad news for you. We're all mutants. There's no doubt about it. These big projects from the major, you know, governments of the world, this is the Wellcome Trust in the UK, there are similar bodies in the States and other countries, busy sequencing human genomes galore and generating these catalogues, and the information goes up on the web and becomes freely available. Each of us, so we're getting some summary statistics now, each of us has in our genome, of those 20,000 genes that we have, we each have about 200 to 300 that are damaged in some way. Okay, so, and about 100 of those are probably risk factors for disease, you know, Mendelian inherited disease. And as I've said before, we have millions of polymorphisms. So we're getting these really good maps, the data is readily available on the web, and this is really, really helping us to do research, which we hope is useful. Okay, take another breath. So I think it's time I told you a little bit directly about our research. I've told you about some of the revolutions that have impacted on what we do and told you a bit about history. This is the sort of stuff my lab does. We do quite a lot of things, some of them well, some of them not so well. And again, if I tried to tell you everything we do, you know, you wouldn't get home tonight. So I'm just going to tell you about one little part of what we do. Well, it's actually a big part of what we do. And it's an area of research we call pharmacogenetics or pharmacogenomics. And the distinction in terms is, well, the pharmaco is easy, that's around drugs. And the genomics or genetics is a question of scale. If we say genetics, we mean one or a few genes. If we say genomics, we mean all of the genes or lots of them. And the idea is that, to a certain degree, drug responses can be modified by your genetic makeup. So the average drug response, or the average response, we call it efficacy in the population, for a given drug is about 60%. So that means about 60% of people will get a decent response to a drug, and the rest, not so. So there are very few, if any, drugs that will treat 100% of the population perfectly. We think that at least some of those failures to be treated are due to genetics. So the idea is, can we help to tailor medication more than it already is by using DNA? In other words, can we look at your individual genetic makeup and decide in advance whether you should get a high dose of a drug, a low dose of a drug, or maybe you shouldn't get that drug at all, you should get something else. So that's the basic principle. Going back in history again, it's good to look back. Science magazine, actually in 1997, they always publish a sort of Research Horizons looking out a year, and this was Research Horizons 1998. They talked about personalised prescriptions. Okay, so. And they said that genetic technologies may eventually revolutionise how medicines or medications are prescribed. So that was going back, and you'll notice that I've done all my research revolutions, and pharmacogenomics is not on it. And there's a good reason for that, because I don't think the revolution has come yet. So it's now 15 years on since science made that statement, and it's fair to say that very few pharmacogenetic tests are used in the clinic routinely. So very rare to be given a genetic test to help guide prescribing. Having said that, there are quite a lot of drugs, more than 100, that have genetic information on the label. So we haven't been idle. There's a lot of information that's gone out, been judged to be useful, and been put on the drug label. But very little of it has enough of evidence to say, thou shalt test the patient for this before you give them the drug. And there's a lot of issues around trying to get those tests organised and being used in a proper fashion. So I'm just going to very quickly tell you in a couple of slides about some of the genes that we have looked at in this regard, just to sort of flesh it out a little bit more for you. We've done quite a lot of work on the metabolism of thiopurine drugs. Again, these are widely used in gastroenterology, and with colleagues Murray Barclay, Richard Gehry, Evan Begg and others and their groups, Rebecca Roberts, who was a PhD student with me and a postdoc, Naren Dunedin. So we've looked at the metabolism of this class of drugs that are often used to control the inflammation and inflammatory bowel disease. Without dwelling on it, the important thing is that the gene, a key gene involved in metabolism of these drugs, has mutations that are relatively common in the population, so that about one person in every 300 has no activity for this enzyme, and so they can't properly metabolise these drugs. And that's quite serious because the drugs can be quite toxic. And 1 in 10 people have quite low activity, and so there's a whole group, and they're actually circled on this graph. They're a whole group of people who probably should get a lower dose of these drugs. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Another gene that we're very interested in, it's quite an important gene. It encodes an enzyme that metabolizes about a quarter of the drugs that are used in the hospital. It's called CYP2D6. It's got a lot of mutations known in the population, and you can live quite happily without this gene at all. In fact, in this room, there's bound to be a few people who don't actually have any CYP2D6 function at all. So they have mutations in both copies. It's about 7% of the population that lack activity. And again, this is just, I won't dwell on it, but it's a distribution of activity of this enzyme in the population. And you can see that there are a group up this end, about 7%, as I said, who don't metabolise drugs very well at all. And there's actually some people who metabolise drugs very quickly. And so there's quite a lot of variability in the population around these things. And just a couple of examples, of concrete examples, where this gene is important, is in the metabolism of codeine, which is, and tamoxifen, the breast cancer medicine, or cancer therapeutic. Both of these are what we call prodrugs. They actually aren't drugs themselves. They have to be metabolized in the body into an active form. And in the case of codeine, it's morphine, and in the case of tamoxifen, it's endoxifen, which is the really active compound or drug. And the enzyme that carries those steps out is CYP2D6. And if 7% of us lack those, then obviously that can have some implications. I've talked a little bit about efficacy of drugs, and so just sort of drug responses, but there are also quite a few serious adverse drug reactions that can be suffered. Fortunately, they're very rare in the main, not very common. And if you remember, the third revolution I talked about was genome-wide association studies, or maybe it was the fourth. Genome-wide association studies have allowed us to find the genes that underlie a lot of these, and I say us in the royal sense, this is international work, but that has identified a whole bunch of genes that impact on your risk of serious adverse drug reactions. And so this is good. It's good except that most of them are so rare that it's uneconomic to test everybody to try and find the one person in 1,000 who's going to get a terrible drug reaction. So you can see the challenge here. How do we predict that someone's going to get liver damage or muscle damage or some other terrible side reaction or adverse drug reaction? How do we do that? I mean, we have the genetic knowledge, but we can't test everybody. The health system would go broke. So this is a challenge. I'll come back to that a little bit later. Well, I'll come back to it now. So I talk about translational issues. So we can do lots and lots of research in the lab, and we have lots of really good clinical colleagues who can do lots of research involving patients, and we enjoy collaborating with them on various things. So we can get a lot of information in the lab. That's not a problem. We can generate a lot of knowledge. But then you've got to translate that knowledge into the real world, and it's never straightforward. Things don't work as well in the real world as they do in a lab or in a research trial. I mean, there's some things listed here. Genetics is only one factor in drug response. It may be a big factor in some cases, a small factor in others. There's a huge amount of research going on out there in the world around pharmacogenetics, and the evidence base is growing in some areas, but it is expensive to do clinical studies, and you know, sometimes the evidence can be conflicting, and it can take a long time before there's consensus about whether using a genetic test is the right way or not. Often there's no guidelines to tell doctors what they should be doing because this is a fairly new science, and so it's hard for them to know what to do. There's questions around who pays for the tests, especially in it's an issue everywhere really. And as I mentioned before, if the gene variant or the adverse drug reaction that you have a potential genetic test for, if it's rare, then how can we afford to test everybody for that? So I think this is a really interesting question. There's this traditional medical paradigm where a patient comes in, you request the test, you pay for the test, you get the result, and you carry on and you manage the patient. And I think it's interesting to think about alternatives to that mode, and I'll come to that shortly. Okay, this is perhaps getting a little bit dry, but it's worth thinking about the cost of the tests that are used currently in pharmacogenetics. And there's some companies around New Zealand, particularly Canterbury Health Labs, do a wide range of tests, including some tests for drug, genes relevant to drug response. And they're generally around about the $100 to $200 mark, but some of them are very expensive. You know, the cytochrome 2D6 test is $1,600, which I suspect doesn't get requested very often because you'd need to be pretty sure it was worth doing. And all of these tests, without fail, focus on known or common gene variants. So these are known in the population, and they're known to be the most common. And that's fine, except that actually we've now realised this is only a part of the story. And with all the personal genomes, all the genomes that have been sequenced have shown us that we all carry quite a significant number of mutations and polymorphisms that we'll never see anywhere else in the population. So we each have our own individual set of private mutations. So we're going to miss all of those if we're just picking the common things. And this is just a paper that shows precisely that if you go looking in different genes, you'll find a lot of variation in the population that we didn't actually expect was going to be there. So I've been thinking a little bit about, and this is now speculation, I guess, rather than fact, and I've been thinking, how would you improve this whole idea of pharmacogenetic testing? And so there's a few things that would make it really good. There's the obvious one, which is it would be really good to have the gene tests there available before you prescribed a drug. It would be really great, actually, if you could do all the genes that might be relevant, not just one or two. And it'd be good if you're going to do that to look at all of the possible gene variants, not just the common ones. And please, could you give us really good guidance so that the doctor knows exactly what to do with that information, because they're busy and they haven't got time to go and read 10 papers. They need to be told, give this patient half the dose, or don't give this patient that drug at all. And the health system's broke, so we can't afford much. So if we could make that a fairly inexpensive test, that'd be good. And if you could just do it once and once in a lifetime, that'd be even better. And so I guess you're kind of realising where I'm going with this, and you'll probably remember, or maybe you're trying to forget, that slide, the human exome, costs less than $1,000. And the way the costing of DNA sequencing has been going, the rate of the technology advancement and the decreasing costs, this will probably come down. It can't come down too much more, but it will come down. And so here's a test that's less than $1,000. And it might give you most of the information you need. And you could consider doing that early in life, which is a kind of controversial thing to say. And just to put a little bit of our research in here, we have a small study. A PhD student, Ing-Wei Chua, and I are doing a study, which is really a pilot. We're just trying to learn how to do this, and then we're going to grow it. And we want to try and take this a bit further. So it's called U-Drugs, and we're trying to apply genomic sequencing methods to understanding severe adverse drug reactions in patients in New Zealand patients, basically. We can't afford to do too many, so we're being very choosy about who we pick. And when we find somebody where we think there's a particular gene involved, we'll home in on that gene and we'll sequence the whole gene. And if we don't know precisely what gene, we'll consider doing an exome analysis. So we're just trying to learn how to do these things. And so this, we think, is a small step towards this idea of a single gene test eventually. Okay, time for a breath. And you'll be pleased to know, I think we're on the home run here. So not too much longer. So this is a controversial thing to say, but it follows on from what I've just said. I suggested that maybe an exome analysis could be a really useful pharmacogenetic test, because it will give you everything you need to know. You only have to do it once. You just need a good way of getting the information out to where it's needed, to the clinician in the main, or maybe the patient as well. We do in New Zealand, as in many countries, we have birth blood spot tests. Something like 28 metabolic disorders are tested by biochemical methods. So here's a provocative statement. Maybe replacing that with a personal genome or an exome, while initially it could be a lot more costly, it's a thought that's worth thinking about for the reasons I've just mentioned in terms of pharmacogenetics. The fact that once you've got the data there, as we learn more and more about what all these genome differences mean, we can update that information so that it can be continually updated. And then the difficult part, and the part that may be certainly more contentious, is you could use that to screen for carriers of genetic diseases so they have that information. But I think if you suggest that to a medical clinical geneticist now, they'll run screaming from the room, because they're already overworked. There's already a huge burden on them and the health system, and it's not clear how you would handle the greatly increased number of carriers and the family follow-ups that would need to be done and so on. So this isn't straightforward, but it's worth thinking about. And maybe with all those complex diseases that I talked about and all the genetic knowledge, there's the opportunity with a genome sequence up front to do risk prediction. So I think, you know, these are forward-looking ideas which we should think about, and they're not without considerable ethical risk. So I'm not saying these things lightly. And that brings me to one of my favourite movies. My family always tell me I have questionable taste in movies. And I tried showing this to my wife one night and she fell asleep. But if you see the whole thing, you can see how good it is. It really is good. It's a good movie. So I heartily recommend it. I was told to watch it by a medical student who's now a colleague many years ago, and I'm glad I did. Gattaca. So Gattaca is a world where everything is controlled by your DNA sequence. You're either a valid, where your DNA was, where you were created by sort of genetic engineering, controlled breeding, if you like, or you're an invalid, where you had natural birth and your parents just went off and had you. And all the natural invalids, they do all the menial jobs, you know, in society, and all the valids can go and do professional things like become, you know, spaceship pilots. So it's about that. So that's a society we probably wouldn't want to end up with. And when you start talking about whole genome sequences and where it could end, I think Gattaca is really relevant, because we don't want to go there. We have to acknowledge that genome sequence data has a lot of medical value, but we talk about incidental findings now. That's finding things that we didn't want to know. So we get exome sequence. What if we find a breast cancer gene mutation in that sequence, which that person did not know they had, and they may not want to know, or they may want to know? You have to think all that through beforehand. You have to be very clear about how you're going to handle that information. And this is going to be more and more of an issue with genome sequence data. So the consenting of patients into research studies, or even the consenting for doing a kind of a clinical exome, needs to be very thorough. And this is an area itself of considerable research around the world. Obviously, once you've generated the information, it's got to be managed in a secure way. You can't just give it out to people. You probably don't want your employer or your insurance company to have it. And you probably don't want everybody else to look at it either, so you need to think about that. And really, this is you know, going to require multidisciplinary approaches. But there are, you know, it's great to see the legal profession, policymakers, and so on thinking about these things. And I think that's what's required. We have to think about how this technology gets brought into practice, or if it gets brought into practice, then I think there's a clearer and safer way forward. And I tell my students, I know it bores them, but the difference between a desirable and undesirable future lies purely in the decisions we make today. So we can do all the research we like in the lab, but we as society then have to decide how that research gets used and how it's managed. Okay, so we're nearly there, and I have a couple of very important things to do. The first is to acknowledge some people who do all the work in my lab. PhD students don't do all the work, but I started assembling this rogues gallery of these great people. They're all wonderful, they're all unique, and they're all committed. This is all the PhD students I've had as a primary supervisor. I've worked with many other PhD students, but often in a co-supervisory role. And when you look at that, apart from you know, the enthusiasm, dedication, energy, and everything else that these people bring, they represent 50 person years of research. So that's 50 years of research, and I couldn't do that. I'd be pushing it to do it in one career. Let alone, you know, maybe two. But so it's just an acknowledgement that your PhD students come here, they come to be trained, they work hard with uncertain futures. I'm pleased to say that everybody, I think, in this panel is now working in some capacity, except for the ones who are still in my lab. And, you know, they make a huge commitment. And I think it's really great that still there are people who are keen to come and learn these techniques and take them on into the next generation. That's the PhD students. Here's the lab. And I can't acknowledge everybody, but I would really like to acknowledge Alison. Yes, George down there is our mascot. I'd really like to acknowledge Alison. She's been with me over 20 years now, and fantastic, steady as a rock, really is the source of all knowledge in the lab. People come to me, but they quickly realise that they should have asked Alison, so that's great. Yeah, George looked after the lab while we were out of the building for 2 years, and Murray Clark, the building supervisor, told me that actually George had frightened quite a lot of people in his time there, because any time someone visited the lab, George would move position and suddenly he'd appear in the lab with his lab coat on, and the builders used to get quite a fright, apparently. So he's quite short and hairy looking. But great bunch, and without them we would be nothing. And I put this in because I hate forgetting things. You know, I often forget to say things and regret it. So a huge thank you to my family and friends for tolerating my obsession. It really is an obsession. I'm the guy who's always writing a grant application or doing stupid things in the middle of the night. And the many colleagues, collaborators and support staff that make this a fantastic institution to work at. Many colleagues here and throughout the country and internationally. Great place to work. I've been very privileged and looking forward to staying here for a fair while. And the people who funded our research, and you can see quite a range of funders. And on a lighter note, I'll end there.